You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
Today we bring you the latest in the Brexit series from Catherine Bernard of Cambridge University. This episode was meant to be the final CB2903 podcast before the due date of withdrawal on the 29th of March. Now that date has been extended to April the 12th in order for the Prime Minister to get Parliament's approval to her withdrawal agreement. But even that is looking unlikely, as Professor Bernard explains to journalist Bonnie Soanes.
Where to start? I think there are a number of problems. I think her first mistake was not to gather together a government of all the talents or a royal commission or something of that sort in that crucial summer of 2016 to try and work out what on earth Leave actually meant. We know that Leave won the referendum, but it had many shades of Leave, and the genius of the Leave campaign was to bring all of those shades under one umbrella. But of course, this is part of the problem that we're experiencing now. What does Leave mean? Should it mean a very hard Brexit, as some of the hard Brexiters in the European Research Group, the ERG, want? Or does it mean some sort of more soft Brexit along the lines of Norway plus? And still, those answers haven't been decided upon. And that's been a real problem because, of course, the strong ERG voice, which has been so influential in the Cabinet on Theresa May's actions, has drowned out the other alternatives. And increasingly, it looks like we are going to leave with a no-deal Brexit, not now on the 29th of March, but on the 12th of April, so only in a couple of weeks. Time. So that was one. Secondly, it was triggering Article 50 in March 2017 without a clear plan of attack. Unlike the EU, that had got its ducks in a row very quickly, and it was the EU that called all the shots. It was the EU that said, we have got to sort out the past liabilities, the divorce, what's now known as the withdrawal agreement, before we even get to talking about the future. And this has been disastrous for the UK. To have those two stages so clearly separated has meant we get the problem with the backstop, because the backstop is there in case there is no future deal, and it's there to try and avoid a hard border in Northern Ireland. And yet, because the EU refused to talk in concrete terms about the future, therefore you have the backstop, which has been the bone of so much contention for so many months. So those were the two biggest problems, I think. But there have been others too. I think it's been Theresa May's failure to engage with people from both sides of the House. The fact that she's listened so much to the ERG, the fact that she has really failed to explain to the public about the trade-offs which will inevitably arise. Trade-offs between staying close to the EU, which is better for our economy, but where we will have more restrictions on sovereignty, or staying much further away from the EU, more of a Canada-style model, better for sovereignty, but very bad for the economy. And she has never, ever explained these trade-offs. And the trouble is, the mantra of Brexit means Brexit acted as a huge sticking plaster to disguise all of the tensions underneath.
And of course, we've had phrases like a red, white and blue Brexit early on from Theresa May. But she was a Remainer who got the job, a poison chalice, some say, of being the British Prime Minister to guide the UK out of the EU. And she very quickly, as you said, triggered Article 50, drew up her red lines, which meant no single market, no freedom of movement and no customs union. And she's been caught in that trap. But isn't it also true that Article 50 has never been triggered by a nation state before? And some are saying that the EU as a club is rather like Hotel California. You can check in, but you can never leave. There is some truth in that too, that Theresa May is steering a course, but no one's ever steered it before.
That's certainly the case. Article 50 was only included for the first time by the Treaty of Lisbon in 2009. And so it's never been used before. And given the mess that we are currently in, it's unlikely to be used again by any nation state. But I think in terms of checking out but never leaving? It's not so clear. What Theresa May and the government, I think all politicians, failed to realise was just how deeply enmeshed we are in EU rules. Now, for many people, that's why they voted to leave. But on the other hand, for highly technical areas like single energy market, like public procurement, EU law actually works really pretty well, and it's highly technical, highly complex, and it's very difficult to unpick. It's like a piece of knitting. Wherever you pull, it has effects in all sorts of other areas, and it makes it very difficult operationally not only to exit from that arrangement, but also to set up your own arrangements in an incredibly short space of time. And this is one of the major issues, that Article 50 only allows for 2 years for a dramatic transformation of the economy and of the regulatory landscape, and also of all sorts of policies that the UK has had to invent in a very short period of time, agriculture, immigration being good examples.
So does Article 50 need rewriting?
Probably, but given how difficult it is to revise the Treaty on European Union, I don't think there'll be a rush to do it, certainly not a rush to do it and make it easier for a state, because look at the problems that the UK has experienced.
And that may well be what the EU is trying to achieve, i.e. you can't leave this club because it's too difficult. But putting the past to one side, coming to the present, I know that you've said May's withdrawal agreement, as an agreement, as a text, is a fine legal text. But are people getting confused in the debate, which has never been more heightened than this week when people are talking about whether May should stay or go as Prime Minister? But are people getting confused between the withdrawal agreement and the subsequent political agreement, which is vague, because they're trying to tie up our future trade relationship with Europe with the withdrawal agreement, which, as you said, is just about the divorce, not about the future trading relationship?
That's right. And there is a lot of confusion, not helped by the fact that each time there's been a meaningful vote, the meaningful vote in the House of Commons has been on the withdrawal agreement, that's a legally binding text, plus the political declaration, which is not legally binding and contains a very crude footprint of what our future relationship might be. And the trouble is, the political declaration too is a document for all men and women, because at one point it looks like that we should be leaving the customs union and terminating free movement of persons, but at another point it suggests that we will be staying in some type of customs arrangement. So it's extremely unclear, and that's why Jeremy Corbyn talks about us doing a blind Brexit. Clearly, we can't even start talking about the future until we have concluded the withdrawal agreement, and that means meaningful vote. And once the meaningful vote is passed, if it is passed,
Number three,
we then need to translate the text of the withdrawal agreement into the Withdrawal and Implementation Bill, the WAB, which nobody has seen sight of yet because it's such a sensitive political document. And that's one of the reasons why the EU gave us some more time until the 22nd of May to get the meaningful vote through and the WAB. The problem is, the EU knows perfectly well there is so much resistance to the withdrawal agreement that the meaningful vote may never get passed. And that's why they said, right, you've got to decide by the 12th of April what you want out of all of this. And if we don't get back to them, if we don't have a meaningful vote, and if nothing else is put into place, we will crash out of the EU, we'll leave the EU without a deal on now the 12th of April 2019, i.e. 2 weeks later than the original plan date.
Now, what's being said is that Theresa May should announce that she is going to leave and when she's going to step down as Conservative Party leader and Prime Minister, and then the hardline ERG group that you mentioned will vote for the meaningful vote number three on the condition that they know when she's leaving. But that will allow them, the so-called hardline Brexiteers, to take charge of the political agreement and decide what type of trading relationship we have in Europe after the transition period is over, after the next 2 years. How likely is it that any new leader will be able to mould that political agreement into their own version of Brexit, whatever that might be?
Well, it would certainly be possible, because the political declaration is not legally binding. And as I said, it's very flexible in scope at the moment. And there's enough flexibility within it to either have some sort of Canadian-style free trade agreement, which seems most likely, or some sort of Norway-style agreement in the future. And much depends on the profile of the next government, and particularly the next Prime Minister. And that's what the fight is all about. Now, you can see there's something rather appealing to the ERG to say, we'll agree to your withdrawal agreement, which will then take us into transition. Note, if there's no withdrawal agreement, there will be no transition period. Then that gives us 2 or 3 years to negotiate the future arrangement. And then Theresa May goes after the local elections in May. There's a leadership contest over the summer. And then the new leader is crowned at the Conservative Party conference in October. So you can see that's a very appealing timetable. The stumbling block is Theresa May doesn't want to go. And she is stubborn and resistant to all entreaties to go. We saw the meeting at Chequers yesterday. Apparently, Jacob Rees-Mogg told her that she needed to go and she didn't answer. And so, given the fact that there was a leadership contest before Christmas, and under Conservative Party rules, there can't be a second leadership contest until a year's time, so the end of this calendar year, she is entitled to stay put, no matter how much people say she should go. I think it's quite striking that the front page of The Sun today contains an editorial that says, you must go, your time is up. But she seems to be resistant so far. And I think she's increasingly tacking towards a no-deal Brexit on the 12th of April, and that will be very damaging to the economy indeed.
Indicative votes may be laid down in Parliament this week when the MPs themselves are said to take control of the Brexit agenda and vote on what they can agree on, not just vote against what they can't agree on. And who knows what Labour will say about a second referendum then, or remaining in the customs union. That's just political speculation at the moment. But we know the Brexit Select Committee, chaired by Hilary Benn, hasn't been able to write unanimous reports. It has produce majority reports, but not unanimous one. That doesn't bode well, does it, for the indicative votes, that perhaps Parliament won't be able to agree, and as you say, will slide towards that new deadline of the 12th of April that the EU has given the UK. How likely is it that Parliament, in taking control, actually won't be able to assert control because it won't be able to agree to anything?
I think there's a real risk in that. And while indicative votes sound rather appealing at a superficial level, the trouble is the chamber is set up on a binary basis. Two sides, essentially, yay or nay. And so the subtlety associated with an indicative vote is very problematic. And the risk is, as was the case with House of Lords reform, that the indicative votes don't indicate anything much at all, apart from the fact that Parliament is divided. And so then you start to think, well, how on earth do we get out of this impasse? Well, one possibility is to call a general election, which seems to be the more favoured outcome. But, of course, then for the Conservatives, they would go into a general election with Theresa May as leader. And we know how well that ended for the Conservative Party in the 2017 election.
And the Withdrawal and Implementation Bill, whatever happens with the Meaningful Vote 3, that actually there's still a lot of legislation to go through Parliament.
Lots of legislation. That's why the EU gave us till the 22nd of May to try and get that legislation through. Now, some people say if there is a meaningful vote with a strong view in favour of the withdrawal agreement, therefore the WAB, implementing the withdrawal agreement, will go through Parliament relatively smoothly. Others say if it's very close on the meaningful vote, then actually the WAB will give the Brexiteers a further opportunity to really cause trouble by voting against all aspects of the withdrawal agreement bill. And this is what the government is really worried about. And there's much talk about Peel and the repeal of the Corn Laws, that Peel was so reliant on opposition votes to get the repeal of the Corn Laws through Parliament. But then when he tried to get further legislation through, those same opposition supporters blocked it and he left office and the Conservatives were more or less out of office for a generation. There's real fear that that is going to be repeated again. And that's why they're very worried about relying on Labour votes to try and get the meaningful vote through and then the WAB through.
Well, we have already mentioned three dates in this podcast. We've dealt with the past and the present, but those dates are the 29th of March, as I say, just a few days away, and we're not going to leave the EU then, and we were supposed to. The 12th of April, which the EU has given as a new date for May to get her meaningful vote and her withdrawal agreement, number three, through Parliament, and then the 22nd of May to get the necessary legislation through too, if not we then have to take part in the EU elections. So looking to the future, Catherine, where do you think we'll be? Should we revoke Article 50? There's an online petition that's already got 5 million signatures in the space of a few days, and you've previously suggested a royal commission. I mean, where are we headed?
It's a fool's game to predict any of the above. The only thing that we can do unilaterally without having to depend on the EU's agreement is actually to revoke Article 50. That was the Whiteman decision decided by the Court of Justice before Christmas. And Whiteman was very clear that if we decided to revoke Article 50, we did it unconditionally, that would need an Act of Parliament in the UK as well. But if we did that, therefore, we would stay a member state of the EU on exactly the same terms as we are at the moment, i.e. not in Schengen, not in the Eurozone, paying the fees that we pay at the moment with the benefit of the rebate. So revoking Article 50 to Remainers looks very attractive, and more than 5 million of them have signed a petition asking for just that. And that's more than 10% of the electorate, and it's, you know, it never before has there been such a large petition. But of course, the Leavers don't see it that way, and they would see revoking Article 50 as a betrayal. If we were to revoke Article 50 to say, let's have a rethink and a restart, then perhaps the Leavers, some of the more moderate Leavers, would accept that. But I find it difficult, and I think there is real concern that there will be a huge backlash, both political and, dare I say it, civil backlash, if there was a revocation of Article 50, which is why the government is so reluctant to do it. We've been around these houses before. General election might or might not break the impasse. The argument in favour is that it would give people a chance to vote, and both parties would have to come up with a manifesto which would say clearly what they want out of the future relationship, whether they want to go down the withdrawal agreement route and then get a political declaration with a view to negotiating the future agreement, or whether they would just want to crash out altogether. Second referendum, well, we saw a million people out on the streets on Saturday saying they want a second referendum, they wanted a people's vote. But at the moment, as we saw last week, there aren't the votes in Parliament to get that through, because any second referendum would also require an Act of Parliament. And so where are we at? It's really difficult. And that's why it may ultimately be that it's Theresa May's deal or nothing. Because if you whittle away all of the others, and there are good reasons why not to do any of the other things, if you whittle all of those away, what's left on the table? Theresa May's deal. And that's what she's counting on. And remember, she came into office to deliver Brexit. She also came into office, as she said, on the steps of Downing Street in July 2016 to do good things. It was a very moving speech she gave about recognising those who've been left behind and giving them opportunities. Because Brexit has been so all-consuming, she has not delivered on that part of her agenda. So the only thing that she can see as her legacy is getting Brexit through. And I think if you see it from that point of view, you see why she's refusing to step down. She is determined to preserve her legacy, and her legacy is to deliver Brexit.
And supposedly not to split her party. But let's just finish. We've dealt with the past, the present and the future. With those three dates, people have been sceptical about how the EU has acted towards the UK over this now 2.5 years. And some Remainers are saying they'd now vote for Brexit because they don't like how the EU has treated the UK. But we've now got three dates, the 29th, the 12th and the 22nd of May. And it's been said that last week the EU didn't want to be seen to giving the UK an ultimatum that it had to pass May's withdrawal agreement when it's put to Parliament, and if it's put to Parliament for the third time. So it didn't make that deadline of the 12th of April conditional. But the EU has kept the 27 members together. The UK Parliament, because, as you say, it's polarised, one side or the other, hasn't been able to reach a consensus and may not do at the end of this week with the indicative votes either. Your assessment, finally, of how the EU has acted. Has the UK wanted cakeism? Has it wanted its cake and to eat it? May did get a bespoke agreement when they'd set out not to give one to the UK. So there were some concessions made. But your assessment, how both sides have acted?
I think the UK has not acted well. It's been difficult circumstances, of course, but I think as we've seen, a combination of the red lines, the premature triggering of Article 50, and a lack of willingness to engage in a cross-party way to deliver this very difficult project have shown the UK at its weakest, not at its best. The EU, by contrast, who have experienced negotiators, who have a track record of delivery, have delivered, and they've played hardball. And it's worth thinking that had Scotland voted to leave the United Kingdom, the rest of the United Kingdom would have played hardball in just the way that the EU is playing hardball with the UK. In fact, I actually think what was agreed in Brussels last week was actually rather clever, because they gave two dates. And in respect of the first date, the 12th of April, it didn't come with a guillotine attached. It's just provided the possibility, extra 2 weeks to see if the meaningful vote could be got through Parliament, and then gave the UK the space to work out what it wants. The trouble is we've had 2 years to try and work out what we want. An extra 2 weeks isn't going to make a difference. And the EU knows that. And the reason why they've set the date of the 12th of April is because the UK, if it stays for longer, which is what Theresa May had been saying last week before she apparently changed her mind, we would need to hold elections for the European Parliament. We haven't got the legislation in place to do that. And of course, other member states need to know whether we're participating, because by the council decision of 2018, a number of our seats currently held by British MEPs are being divvied up amongst the remaining member states. And of course, they need to know how many seats their electorate are going to be voting for. So that's why the significance of the 12th of April. They need to put the legislation in place to get the European Parliament elections to go ahead. Now, I actually think, and Eleanor Sharpstone, the Advocate General, tweeted in her personal capacity in a similar vein, that if there was goodwill on both sides, it might be possible to have some sort of vehicle, some sort of mechanism, whereby existing MEPs from the UK could stay sitting in the European Parliament for a period of time until we actually leave. But the EU has made clear they don't want that. They say it goes to the core of democracy. We must participate in European Parliament elections. And were we to do that, it would become a de facto second referendum.
Now, I know you're not allowed to take sides as a commentator on the EU and this troubled Brexit negotiations, but a Sky poll last week found that 90% of those they surveyed thought this had been a national humiliation for the UK. Do you think it has been?
It's certainly not shown the UK at its best. And I think what I think has saddened both the commentariat in the UK, but also our friends and colleagues in the EU, is that the UK was always seen as the bastion of pragmatism over principle and getting things done in a highly professional way. And all of that reputation has been shot to bits. Now, I should say, I think it's unfair. I think the civil service has generally done an extraordinary job in immensely difficult circumstance, extraordinary job in getting out the statutory instruments that need to be in place for preparing for a no-deal Brexit. They have worked immensely hard. They have also negotiated bilateral agreements over things like healthcare with countries like Spain in the event of a no-deal Brexit. The civil service have got on with it. The trouble is they can only do as much as their political masters will let them. And I'm afraid I think the politicians have let the country down, because they have been so divided and they have been seen to be protecting the interests of their party over the interests of the country. And I think that's why Theresa May's speech last week on the steps of Downing Street was so shocking. She blamed the MPs for not delivering Brexit, rather than recognising that it was a collective failure and that she has responsibility for that failure as well, not least because she's Prime Minister of the country.
Well, finally, we're headed then for a Chilcot-like inquiry into the Iraq war, another huge inquiry into how Brexit has been negotiated, and in particular, how the civil service has been led. But also, we haven't ruled out totally setting up a royal commission. It would be one zigzaggy path that Theresa May could go down.
It would be, and whether you call it a royal commission or a commission of the great and good or some sort of government or a commission of the talents which bring together a number of people from all sides, probably not the extremes, but in the middle of both sides, would be an important way of trying to get more collective responsibility for negotiating the future arrangement. But just to be clear, that future deal is dependent on us settling our past liabilities, which means paying the debts we owe, sorting out the rights of EU citizens, and also in preserving guarantees for the Northern Ireland border. And Bob's your uncle, what does that look like? It looks very much like the withdrawal agreement. So it seems to me the only way forward, leaving aside no deal Brexit, is either signing Theresa May's withdrawal agreement or revoking Article 50 and starting again.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.